Welcome to this special web audio extra CD to our GI Cancer Think Tank, where the faculty comments on additional gastrointestinal cancers, beginning with pancreatic cancer. And to begin, I asked Dr. Fuchs for his thoughts about a case sent in from an oncologist in practice. A 69-year-old man, status post-Whipple for a 3.5-centimeter adenocarcinoma of the pancreas with two positive lymph nodes and negative margins.
To some extent, the standard becomes the CONCO study, namely using single-agent gemcitabine after resection. The existing questions are the role of radiation therapy, where, for the most part, on the other side of the Atlantic, there isn't much use. There's not much enthusiasm for radiation. There's still some on this side, partly because most of our studies in the U.S. and North America have included radiation therapy. But at our center, often if we are to use gemcitabine and we're contemplating radiation, because we don't routinely use it, usually we'll give four cycles of gemcitabine, restage them, and make sure that they haven't progressed before contemplating radiation, just because you want to delay that as long as possible, just to be certain they don't develop any early systemic recurrence. FOLFIRINOX is certainly a question. There is yet no data about using FOLFIRINOX in this setting, so I have not routinely used FOLFIRINOX as an adjuvant.
So that is, of course, one of the key questions. I kind of want to let's just get the group's viewpoint. How do you approach a situation like this, Axel, and would you offer FOLFIRINOX?
Standard of care, exactly what Charlie said. We start with gemcitabine, then consider radiation therapy. We see that patients haven't declared themselves metastatic disease. FOLFIRINOX, not yet. I mean, we cannot always extrapolate from advanced setting to the adjuvant setting. And so we've seen several failed studies where we thought we knew the answer, and it really hasn't been the answer to extrapolate from palliative to adjuvant setting. But I know this. I mean, there is a French trial, the Prodige trial, is investigating currently gem versus FOLFIRINOX. And with the rate they are accruing, I'm sure we'll know the answer quite soon.
Matt?
I would agree. I think FOLFIRINOX always comes up simply because of the data in the metastatic setting. So you have to discuss it, but it's no picnic to give or to receive. And so before moving it to the adjuvant setting, I'd really want to see a little bit more data.
Rich?
I agree with everything that's been said. You know, FOLFIRINOX is hard to take. You commonly end up doing dose reductions. All these people that are post-Whipple are fairly beaten up. And so even though giving it in people with advanced disease is difficult, it probably would be more difficult in the post-operative setting.
Just as long as we brought up this issue of FOLFIRINOX, Bert, we got questions about the issue of dosing of FOLFIRINOX in the metastatic setting and also use of growth factors.
So I have tended to start at the published dose, but as Rich said, most patients need reductions, although we've kind of picked which drugs to reduce based on what the toxicities were. I've used more growth factors with this regimen than I would typically use for colon cancer regimens, and certainly more than I would typically use for gemcitabine, where I essentially never use growth factors, although I haven't started them right out of the gate in most patients, because I think the neutropenia rate's in that kind of 30-40% ballpark where you're going to need it often, but not in everybody.
So, Tony, how do you approach this question of adjuvant treatment for pancreatic cancer? Do you consider FOLFIRINOX?
So the answer is no. At this point of time, we just go with the standard gemcitabine dose and not consider FOLFIRINOX in the adjuvant setting. Now, the neoadjuvant setting is a little different story, if we want to touch upon that. But just to discuss a little bit the role of radiation, which I agree, radiation doesn't seem to have a role. And a lot of discussion has been around the negative margins and the question whether with the positive margins, the R1 resection, you would consider radiation. And in our institution, we actually do not, and I think I'm more convinced that for the R1, there's even a lesser role for the radiation, because R1 resection is actually indicative of metastatic disease, and these patients do not tend to actually die from local recurrence. They tend to present with liver metastases. And if you look at the CONCO study, actually, in the subset analysis, the R1 resection patients ended up with a larger benefit from the addition of systemic therapy with gemcitabine as a single agent.
Alan, what about this issue of selection of adjuvant therapy and use of radiation treatment in pancreatic cancer?
So our center, we don't use radiation, although I guess when we have a margin issue or a posterior margin, there's some debate, but we typically don't use radiation. Even in locally advanced disease, if we use it usually 4 to 6 months down the road rather than early, because most of us believe that the disease is not a local disease. And we also would go with the CONCO data that I think governs until something comes along
so
otherwise.
Do you still believe in Whipples?
We do believe in Whipples, we do. Good question though, but we do plenty of Whipples, but as
one of our famous surgeons, right, Mark Bloomston said, it's a palliative resection. So Whipple is, for most patients, actually at best palliative. You know, for 10% of the patients,
yeah,
you may get a benefit from a Whipple. 90% would not.
What are your thoughts about Whipples, Rich?
Well, I think it's an open question whether we ought to be considering pancreatic cancer a systemic disease in almost all cases. It's pretty hard to violate the old tenets of we operate when we can. And certainly at all of our centers, we have accomplished pancreatic surgeons who, even though they're accomplished, often don't know that their margin's going to be positive until they've committed to doing the procedure. So it's a troubling circumstance and one that's, I think, ripe for developing better strategies.
Tony, you mentioned neoadjuvant therapy. In what situations do you think about it, and are there trials looking at this?
So there are a number of trials looking at this, albeit they're mostly smaller trials, multi-institutional or single institution. The neoadjuvant therapy, I have to be careful about calling this neoadjuvant because most of the studies apply to borderline resectable or unresectable disease rather than clearly resectable disease. In fact, neoadjuvant therapy in pancreas cancer is mostly limited to that subset. And those are patients that are not clearly candidates for a Whipple procedure. And these are the patients that, at least for now, we consider mostly for these neoadjuvant studies, not as much the clearly resectable patient population.
So what would be the kind of situation where somebody would be borderline resectable and converted to resectable? What happens?
So unfortunately, this is not a very clear, it's really surgeon specific, but there are certain specifications about what constitutes a borderline resectable. The clearly resectable patient is, of course, a patient with a pancreatic mass that does not seem to involve vasculature or celiac axis or what have you. The borderline resectable, there's a list of what constitutes a borderline resectable. It's essentially when the surgeon does not feel, upon review of the case, that they can get a clear or a clean margin, albeit some involvement of the portal vasculature or abutment rather than involvement of vasculature, etc. And those are the patients that would probably mostly benefit from neoadjuvant therapy to try to shrink the tumor. And this is where FOLFIRINOX, for example, would have a more important role since it does have a response rate that has been stated to be above 30%, which is in pancreas cancer the highest response rate ever reported. These are the patients that would likely benefit from cytotoxic therapy.
So, Alan, have you had any patients who were converted from non-resectable to resectable? What happened?
We have. This is new territory for us. I personally had two patients. I think our group, we've probably had half a dozen, give or take, who had either borderline or what we thought was clearly unresectable disease based on usually the envelopment of a vessel, you know, 360-degree involvement of a vessel, for example. So by our parameters with radiology, felt to be unresectable, given FOLFIRINOX, and we've converted a number to resectable. And in fact, on one occasion, I got a call from the operating room from the surgeon asking what the hell we'd done because the tumor was like mush, which as opposed to usually the hardball, this sort of rock-hard tumor. So something's doing there. And in fact, the patients I've had remain durably free of disease, even one is a year out from her resection, and is still doing amazingly well. So it's a small sample, and obviously we're picking and choosing who we do it in because it may be the high-performance status patients, but there have been some very surprising results.
I don't know, Axel. Somehow, intuitively, it's harder for me to understand converting unresectable to resectable and pancreatic than, for example, liver mets, where I can understand you shrink them down, you have to take out less tumor, you pull it away from a critical structure. You know, you're not going to sterilize anything with pancreatic cancer, are you?
So it comes down to the vessel involvement and how much vessel involvement you can patch eventually, because nowadays our surgeons have become more aggressive in terms of even vessel reconstruction if they can get tumor-free margins. And I think what Alan pointed to is a new territory, a new frontier. All of a sudden, we have a regimen that actually works and has responses in pancreas cancer. And we're now at a time when we learn how to utilize it. And I can actually see that we're going to approach things like resection of liver metastasis. I had a patient who had a great response to chemotherapy, to FOLFIRINOX, metastatic pancreas cancer, to liver metastasis. The primary tumor almost disappeared, and there was one lesion left in the liver. So eventually, we actually performed a Whipple resection, laparoscopic Whipple, and liver resection. Was this curative? No, but the patient was free of disease for a year, actually 15 months. And I don't think we would have done this and seen this in the era of gemcitabine.
So Charlie, have you had any patients who you sent to surgery with liver mets from pancreatic cancer?
No, probably not.
Have I done it in my career? I've done it twice years ago, and they both failed miserably.
Matt?
Thinking about doing it in one person, but I haven't done it.
Rich?
I've had some patients that I've inherited after they were taken for a Whipple, and the surgeon said, oh, taking this out of the liver is a chip shot, so I'm going to do it and do the Whipple. My experience has been that they've done on the bad end of the spectrum of a bad disease.
So I'm going to go through some of the questions we've gotten about treating pancreatic cancer before we talk about some of the new things that are coming out. First, Bert, in what situations, if any, do you use erlotinib in pancreatic cancer?
I really just don't.
So, Tony, how do you approach obstructive jaundice in metastatic pancreatic cancer, internal stenting versus external drainage?
Frankly, my preference is to do external drainage for most of these patients, specifically the metastatic patients. At least in institutions that have a lot of experience with external drainage, that actually seems to be quite safe and effective. With internal drainage, i.e. RCP and placement of a stent, the challenge is a lot of these block again, especially upon progression, makes it very difficult for us to put them on clinical trials or continue treatment. With external drainage, we had much better success rate, and we're able to monitor and continue to actually challenge.
Charlie?
I'm interested to hear that, Tony, just because at our center, we prefer internal. And in fact, in our studies, we actually exclude patients if the stent can't be internalized because of the high rate of infection with the external drain. So our studies actually prevent patients with pancreatic cancer to go on if they can't get an internal drain.
Well, so the point is that you can do both and it's okay. In my actually experience, I've had much more trouble with the internal stents. They do tend to block and we end up actually having to eventually place external drains. There are certain patients where, you know, the bilirubin is mildly elevated. Clinically, they don't seem to be as obstructed. These patients may benefit from internal drainage. But for those with, which are the majority of the patients with larger tumors, you know, actual impingement, at least in my experience, we've had much better luck with external drainage. And we've actually had very little risk of infection. I mean, we have, as all these institutions do, you know, a very good interventional radiology team that actually follows up these patients very closely. And we've had very, very few problems.
All right, so Bert, there was an interesting presentation at ASCO by Dr. Van Hoff looking at, quote, actionable targets in pancreatic cancer. Can you comment on that?
Sure. You know, this is in some ways similar to one Alan talked about earlier, with emphasis being on what does actionable mean. But I think this is one of the larger cohorts of pancreatic cancer samples studied by a variety of methodologies, including immunohistochemistry for select targets, looking at protein overexpression, then looking at whole genome expression analysis with an Illumina bead chip and limited sequencing for common mutations. So they've just sort of given us a spectrum of mutations in really a relatively large number of patients. So, you know, over 1,000 for the immunohistochemistry and about 450 for the whole genome analysis and about 800 for the select mutations, which included common things like KRAS, EGFR, PIK3CA, and BRAF. And so really they've cataloged for us some amplifications. I think, you know, this is a test that can be ordered clinically. This is the, I believe, the KRAS DX test. So obviously this test provides a person with a very large amount of information, I would say the majority of which I wouldn't know what to do with. They have identified, I think, some potentially actionable targets, although I think you have to leave the word potentially in there. Some that stood out, one I mentioned before, is that the rate of KRAS mutation is a little less than we thought in the past, about 73%. And this is a fairly large sample, so I think that's probably a more stable number than we've seen from other studies. One other interesting thing they saw was amplification of HER2-NU in about 10%. So I think that may well be something we should think about for studies, although I don't know that I'd consider that actionable in an individual patient if we ordered that. What I don't know about this study is how these samples were obtained. I suspect that many of them were obtained surgically. So these may be patients who, at least some of whom, never went on to develop metastatic disease. So I think if we were going to think about this clinically, we'd like to have actual metastatic tumor samples. And for the average pancreas cancer patient, it's hard to get enough tissue to do all of these assays. So this is a sort of a treasure trove of information, genetic information, and especially expression information about these tumors. In terms of does it move the field forward right now, I don't think so, partly because this is not attached to any outcomes from specific therapies. So that's really the huge missing piece here that will need to be worked on with future studies.
So Axel, any more hints in terms of the biology of pancreatic cancer, in terms of why it's so resistant to systemic therapy, and you know, maybe what kinds of strategies might be more promising for the future?
You know, when you take a patient to an autopsy after they die from pancreas cancer, and I recently did that, a patient who died on service, and the residents and fellows actually came to the surgery room, and actually we did an autopsy on this patient, which we don't do often enough, I guess. And I was struck again by how hard, how fibrotic the tissue is. You could knock on the tumor, it's like knocking on wood. This is not highly vascularized, soft tissue, where chemotherapy easily penetrates in. And this has been known for quite some time. So this fibrotic component of the cancer could be an impediment to delivery of chemotherapy. And we've tried to target that with hedgehog inhibitors. They work amazingly well in very intriguing results in animal models. But so far, they've really failed in clinical studies, you know, to show benefit when added to chemotherapy. But I do believe that a better understanding about the tumor-host interaction, what generates this very fibrotic, very hard, impenetrable tissue, I think is key to our understanding of how to better deliver chemotherapy into these patients.
So Axel, and I think this is true when it comes to the primary tumor. This is a bit different when we're talking about the metastatic tumors, because it's interesting, even with the chemotherapy studies, you actually do see a differential response between the primary, which seldom actually shrinks, when you see a good response with the metastatic tumors. So what applies to the primary tumor is a little bit different. And that goes to one of the first questions you were asking about, would you ever remove the primary plus the liver, let's say it's two liver mets. And anecdotally, I had few patients in the last few years where the primary was taken out, liver tumors were found during surgery. Those patients actually ended up with the best outcomes. Again, you know, subjectively, could have been super selection, but they've had some of the best outcomes I've had with patients. They've had good responses. I didn't have to worry about the primary. But these, again, these are anecdotal.
So getting back to this issue of next generation sequencing and more sophisticated assays like what we were just talking about, I'm just kind of curious, Charlie. I mean, anybody you ask about these things, the first thing they go is, we don't know what to do with the information. But on the other hand, you know, you put yourself in the position of a younger, healthier patient who's already gone through all the conventional options, whether it's pancreatic cancer, colorectal cancer, just on the possibility that maybe some kind of actionable lesion would be seen, maybe they could get into a trial. Can you buy into the thought of doing this kind of thing outside a trial setting?
Well, I think it's a discussion that happens frequently, and it's been the subject of a series of articles in the New York Times the past few weeks. We all want to find that anecdote where we find the needle in the haystack and a patient who would otherwise have done poorly did well because you found that person with the rare mutation that's actionable. Unfortunately, that is decidedly uncommon and is related to our discussion earlier today. We don't even know if that mutation matters in that disease, akin to BRAF and colon cancer. So I think this is going to be a process where first we characterize these tumors extensively using various technologies. So we look at the RNA, the DNA, the protein, so we really understand it. And then we sort of sort through that data to try to understand what the individual subsets or phenotypes are. And then presumably we do even small studies, pilot studies, where we take our best shot at that molecular phenotype.
So I want to move on and talk a little bit about biliary cancer. And Alan, we wanted you to address a number of clinical questions that we've received. What constitutes biliary cancer? Is there any difference in management based on the location? What's your usual first and second line therapy? Is there a role for next generation sequencing? Would you like to comment on some of those questions?
Sure. So biliary tract is actually part of the GI system, and it's the bile ducts within the liver, the small radicals up to the common bile duct, the gallbladder, the cystic duct, and then the extrahepatic bile duct as it passes through the pancreas and enters the small intestine at the ampulla of Vater. So that's all biliary. I often tell one of my colleagues in the patients with pancreas cancer who seem to do very well that it may very well be a bile duct cancer that happens to be located in the pancreas, because the biology is quite different on average. Now, the big difference is I think there's more and more awareness of peripheral cholangiocarcinomas, which are peripheral bile duct cancers that I think have a very different natural history than the others. Gallbladder cancer, intrahepatic and extrahepatic biliary cancers, or at least how to subset them, and we should probably subset them more. The unifying factor is, of course, all of these patients, the major driving force of their survival and their quality of life will be both the metastatic disease and the bile flow. And I think if you can affect adequate bile drainage, patients will do much better than if you don't. And some of this is a function of where the disease is, how they present, your ability to stent them. Some people will have stents that can last for a year without problems, and other people will have infections repeatedly every 3 weeks, and you can never get an opportunity to do anything with them. So there's that. My approach, for example, on a peripheral cholangiocarcinoma is often to watch the patient for a few months, because many of these tumors are found incidentally. But of course, most patients with gallbladder or bile duct cancer that causes jaundice or symptoms are different. Now, gallbladder cancer tends to be a more virulent disease, I think. With visceral metastases, it tends to be a bad disease. The only time you cure gallbladder disease is when you find it coincidentally, more or less, when you do a cholecystectomy and find a confined gallbladder cancer. And then intrahepatic bile ducts depends on where. So the unique patient is the one with the Klatskin's tumor, for example, which is a tumor right at the bifurcation of the right and left ducts. And those are curable patients because they present early enough before they've metastasized. And there's a recent paper actually looking at transplant for those patients, for unresectable patients. And in fact, there are some long-term survivors. But that's a subset. Patients who have more bulky...
Liver transplant.
Liver transplant for Klatskin's for early cholangiocarcinoma with excellent outcomes. That was from Mayo Jacksonville, actually.
Yeah, Mayo has a large transplantation program for cholangiocarcinomas.
Involves chemoradiation.
Chemoradiation, brachytherapy.
Right. So you do find some of these patients will do very well, but you have to be super selective. Most of these patients, you know, the cancer tends to track up, be insidious and track up the bile duct, and you often have trouble getting a clean margin. But again, I think we tend to split. So gallbladder is different than the intrahepatic cholangio is different than the more central cholangio.
Let me chime in here. I mean, one of the issues while this liver transplantation program came about is a lot of patients actually have a pre-existing condition called PSC, like inflammatory bowel disease, PSC, cholangiocarcinoma. So similar to liver cirrhosis, you actually transplant a new organ and eliminate the actual causative disease for the pre-malignant condition.
And I should say that one problem with the transplant literature is it's not easy to get tissue diagnosis in some of these patients. So actually, there was a paper in the transplant journal that Katie Kelly and I wrote a commentary on, an editorial on, where the long-term survivors were overrepresented by people who never had tissue confirmation. So you do probably transplant some people and treat them who may not have malignancy.
I have had a patient like that. Yes.
Yeah.
So what about systemic therapy? And Tony, let me present a case that an oncologist presented to me. 75-year-old gentleman, absolutely healthy, 3 to 4 month presentation with abdominal distress, burping, particularly fatty foods. They thought he had gallbladder disease, CAT scan. They thought they saw a mass, may have meant, might have been a lymph node, and he ended up having surgery. The patient was opened up, had extrahepatic bile duct cancer that was considered unresectable. What would you be thinking about at this point?
And non-metastatic.
Right.
Unresectable, non-metastatic. So this tends to be mostly a local disease for a long while. So the question is whether you would treat with systemic chemotherapy, whether you treat with chemotherapy, radiation, or both. Tendency, at least in our clinics now, is, you know, having an active systemic therapy is to treat these patients with 2 to 3 months of chemotherapy, test their biology, and then rescan, and then consider chemotherapy and radiation for the local disease.
What kind of chemotherapy do you usually use?
So the standard has shifted to gemcitabine and cisplatin as per the ABC study. For the radiation, typically capecitabine and radiation.
So actually, Bert, this patient received cis and gem, was stable in terms of the tumor, but developed overwhelming fatigue, which the physician thinks is related to the treatment. What would you be thinking about at this point, and how do you deal with the issue of fatigue in patients receiving this treatment?
Well, one potentially good thing about the strategy Tony mentioned is that it might allow that patient to come off therapy for some time after radiation. So doing that strategy of chemotherapy, then chemoradiation might allow the patient some sort of break, maybe even a long break from all sorts of therapy. You know, I think like any patient with advanced disease and ongoing chemotherapy, there's always this trade-off between patient's symptoms and what kind of benefit they're getting. And I think that with a regimen where you've got gemcitabine and cisplatin, sometimes taking out the cisplatin component can help a lot. The gemcitabine tends to be more tolerable from a fatigue, asthenia standpoint. So I think that's one option you'd have in this person if you had elected not to proceed to radiation.
So one of the things we've done actually with gemcitabine cisplatin, you know, as published gemcitabine cisplatin is weekly, 2 weeks in a row and a week off. And I think the day one and day eight gemcitabine and even cisplatin are actually tough on most patients. We've actually, many times we've given gemcitabine every other week. In fact, if you look at 1/3 of the patients will lose that day eight anyways when you go on 3 to 4. So effectively, if you look at the dose intensity of gemcitabine across studies, it's typically 2 to 3 doses every 4 weeks. So we've actually been able to give more consistently gemcitabine and cisplatin every other week. So day 1 and day 15 of every 4 week cycle with much less toxicity than observed on the study.
What is your second line therapy?
For this particular, outside of clinical trials, of course, there is not much data. But we've tended to give the, again, not to seem like Rich was saying that FOLFOX is the treatment for all, but FOLFOX is a very reasonable option for those patients as a second line.
So Rich, we asked if you could comment on a paper in The Oncologist looking at mutations in cholangiocarcinoma, specifically isocitrate dehydrogenase 1 and 2.
Sure. So I don't think isocitrate dehydrogenase was on the tip of many people's tongues before reading this article. But this article comes out of MGH, and we've talked about their program, which is called Snapshot, where they're sequencing tumors early on in the patient's course of therapy and really trying to learn what the meaning of that is and also trying to apply it to the choice of phase one drugs. Well, this was sort of a shot in the dark. Let's see what we find when we sequence a whole bunch of tumors. And they originally had 12 patients with cholangiocarcinoma and noticed that there was a relatively high frequency of mutations in IDH1 and IDH2. So then they went on and pulled another 75 patients from the archives and looked at it there and saw about a 30% likelihood of this. So it was sort of a shot in the dark that hit the target. The trouble is it a target that has meaning? Is it something that you can drug? And is it a driving mutation or is it just an epiphenomenon? So I don't think we really know the answer to those questions, but if we don't investigate them, we'll never find the answer. So, you know, I think that this sort of a program is a pioneering effort and is really important. How much of it is going to end up being useful clinically, I don't know. But this kind of a study, this kind of an article, I think helps us open doors to other investigations like this. And this is being done in a CLIA-certified lab, so it's legally, your findings can be actionable in the event that there's a drug that targets the mutation that you've found.
I'm kind of curious, Matt, just sort of globally looking at GI cancers in general. I mean, obviously, this is a huge spectrum. But in terms of this concept of oncogene addiction, how, when it's all fleshed out, do you have any sense for how prominent a role it's going to play with GI cancers? You know, in lung cancer, a few years ago when the EGFR mutation was defined, people were estimating maybe 10% of all lung cancer might have, quote, actionable mutations. Now they're talking 50, 60 plus percent. Any idea where this might be heading in terms of GI cancers?
I think it's clearly part of the story, but I definitely don't think it's the whole story. We are sort of coming back to this idea that it's very exciting, but perhaps somewhat simplistic to say that we can identify 100 mutations and these are the mutations, and if we just target them appropriately, we can make these cancers shrink. I think probably down the road, the story is going to be more complex. We may end up needing to do exome sequencing, whole genome sequencing to really put together the story and get a fuller understanding, again, of what the context is for these mutations so that we can really be smart about how we target them.
So, Charlie, another question from an oncologist about biliary cancer. 57-year-old woman underwent a cholecystectomy for presumed gallstones, found to have gallbladder adenocarcinoma. Another surgery was done with wider excision resection of liver tissue near the gallbladder bed, revealed two positive nodes. Would you recommend adjuvant therapy?
Well, she certainly has a reasonable chance of recurrence because, you know, the ones who do well are the ones who were found incidentally and it's limited to something not beyond the submucosa. With two positive nodes, the risk of recurrence is considerable. If one were to give adjuvant therapy, it would be gemcitabine-based, realizing that, you know, to some extent, we're doing inference from other studies. And I've done it.
Interesting.
You should refer to the study that was just published,
in JCO.
That actually was a very interesting meta-analysis, correct, of multiple studies that does suggest, I mean, we previously have actually used the pancreas data and smaller studies to do the inference of potential advantage in this patient population. I think the meta-analysis suggests that similar benefits are seen across the spectrum of biliary cancers. Now, there are studies that are ongoing looking at that prospectively, but I think the meta-analysis was powerful enough to suggest that there is a role, specifically in a patient like this one, to benefit from treatment.
This was from the Princess Margaret.
Yeah. I mean. So what do you do radiation therapy to?
For gallbladder?
You know, that's very much dependent on the patient and on their status otherwise, and I say there's not a one-size-fits-all, very dependent. I tend not to do radiation. Ideally, we take patients back and resect the gallbladder. Many times they haven't had the gallbladder bed resected. Do that, maybe do a lymphadenectomy. In those patients with clear disease, I don't do radiation. Others, you might if you're suspicious. I mean, the problem again and again and again is the positive margin or the worrisome margin with inadequate surgery. So again, it's very variable.
I think that for this particular patient with an extensive liver surgery, pretty much eliminated the likelihood of having a local recurrence, and radiation may not play as much of a role. Same, of course, for intrahepatic cholangios, radiation does not seem to have a role. I think we limit it to patients with extrahepatic cholangios. Again, the SWOG study that's looking at adjuvant chemotherapy and chemotherapy and radiation, and does include gallbladder in addition to extrahepatic cholangio. But I do believe that extrahepatic cholangio and CLATSCAN tumors are the ones that most likely will benefit from radiation, not as much the others.
Charlie?
I'm sure everyone saw in this issue of JAMA, there's SPEC-3, I think it is, which was looking at periampullary tumors that were resected, randomized to observation, 5-FU or gemcitabine. And the study is not significant. It's underpowered, though, and it does appear to be a trend for those getting gemcitabine in terms of a survival benefit.
Any other issues or questions that you think people have about either pancreatic cancer or biliary cancer that we haven't touched on today, even practical day-to-day issues? Alan?
Well, again, I think the frustration is that we tend to mix these patients and lump them. I think they're distinctly different diseases. But to really study them, we need to go international. There are some parts of the world where these are much more common. And one of my frustrations has been within the groups, our inability to do that. At ASCO, there was a meeting of a group from the UK, which is very organized and has done excellent research. And so I think one of the things that we need to do is be broader in our scope, because if not through that mechanism, we just won't answer questions. But I think there probably are good targets that we might have some opportunities, but it's a matter of having enough patients to show that.
And if I may, you know, just add to that, that I fully agree that gallbladder, intrahepatic and extrahepatic are probably different diseases. From the practical standpoint right now, you can't differentiate them. You're going to treat them all the same with the chemotherapy, gemcitabine, cisplatin, or fluoropyrimidine. But for future studies, and when you look at, we had a MEK inhibitor study that we looked at that was published in JCO about a year ago. We've seen actually differential response between the gallbladder cancers and the intrahepatic and extrahepatic cancers. Gallbladders did the worst, extrahepatic did the best, and intermediately the intrahepatic. And you see these trends with various tyrosine kinase inhibitors and other targeted agents. And so I fully agree that, you know, the future is really to treat those differently, classify them differently, because they likely have different actionable targets. Right now, it's probably not relevant clinically since we're going to treat them all about the same. But for future development, we really need to do better.
Emily, did you have a question?
Just that I think that the progress has been so slow in these diseases. One of the questions that comes up is models, preclinical models, and there's been a little progress in pancreatic cancer models, and I'm just curious if anyone here is aware of progress in biliary tract models, you know, either in terms of human tumor xenografts.
There are inflammatory models. In fact, that's a really good point. In fact, just recently was the first mouse model of hepatocellular carcinoma that sort of recapitulates the disease, cirrhotic mouse model of cirrhosis and HCC. That literally was just in the last 2 months published. So that's a very good point, the inability to get models to
How is this model on HCC done?
It is a knockout of, John Gordon presented it at Journal Club. I'm blanking on the gene. I haven't read the paper itself. I just got a glance of the presentation. But, I mean, the point is, for HCC, for example, the only model that recapitulates the disease is the woodchuck. And I don't know if anybody's ever worked with woodchucks, but it's how much wood can a woodchuck chuck? And, I mean, they are brutal animals. That's a woodchuck hepatitis virus that infects the animals and leads to HCC. Otherwise, none of the models recapitulate the disease. So if you get a model, then at least you have a fighting chance to learn something. So, again, in biliary cancer, I'm not aware of any other than inflammatory models.
Were you going to say something?
Oh, no. I was agreeing that there's no animal model. There are only three or four probably labs that actually have cell lines, human cell lines growing. I mean, we have, at Ohio State, we have one, but there are very few actually that do have cell lines, albeit no models that I can think of that do exist in this disease, unfortunately.
Axel?
So one comment and one question. So interestingly, the two trials that recently moved the bar higher in pancreas cancer and in biliary cancers was good old chemotherapy. Targeted agent. It was actually very easy randomization, pretty straightforward, something we would not even dare to explore here in America. It could only be done by European groups, and we have new standards of care. Actually, we have one standard of care in biliary cancers we never had. So I think this is something that should tell us something about, sometimes in clinical trial designs, we might have to be more pragmatic and really address the clinical need. The question that I have is, you know, we talked about FOLFIRINOX and pancreas cancer. Now, I would assume that still the majority of patients presenting with stage 4 disease and pancreas cancer are not candidates for FOLFIRINOX. It might be a little bit biased and skewed view that we have, you know, referral centers, younger patient population, but the average community oncology patient is probably still a candidate for gemcitabine. Or is there any patient still a candidate for gemcitabine? Is there a role for FOLFOX in these patients? I mean, for a long time, we've tried to move away from gemcitabine, and we were hesitant to do that because we didn't have anything better. But is there time now to explore FOLFOX compared to gemcitabine in a community-based setting, being pragmatic in terms of clinical trial design, setting a new standard of care upon which we can then add new targeted agents better than what failed with gemcitabine? I mean, what do you think? Is there a role for FOLFOX in first line in patients would be considered gemcitabine patients?
In first line, so the poor performance status patient?
Yep.
So remember with FOLFIRINOX, the big debate is, well, is it just a FOLFOX? And I don't think it is just a FOLFOX, but I think we do need to explore treatments in the patients who aren't candidates for FOLFIRINOX. Again, I think the problem I have with gemcitabine is we haven't moved the bar forward even in the good performance status patients. So I think that's another disease where probably half of the patients can't get the treatment that we think is optimal because of their poor performance status.
So have you used FOLFOX in pancreatic cancer?
I mean, you know, sometimes I have patients who are sick from their disease, you know, who are kind of deteriorating from, not from comorbidities, whatever. And I've started with FOLFOX and then add irinotecan to form FOLFIRINOX kind of as a staged approach to kind of ease patients into tolerability of chemotherapy. I don't know whether that's right or wrong, but when patients are sick from their cancer, I tend to give them the benefit of a doubt in trying to turn things around. And there's nothing better than FOLFIRINOX. Now, these patients who are so sick, they're not good candidates for FOLFIRINOX to begin with. So that's the dilemma I'm facing right now. And I would love to have data on FOLFOX in the initial setting to then perhaps even have a better rationale to use FOLFOX in first line.
So I think it goes to the question of whether you should sequence versus just put all your eggs in one basket. I mean, we talked about FOLFOXIRI or FOLFIRINOX in metastatic colorectal cancer. Other than the high response rate, the survival of FOLFOXIRI or FOLFIRINOX is very similar to sequencing FOLFOX, FOLFIRI, and FOLFIRI, FOLFOX. Of course, you get much less toxicity.
Yeah, but in pancreas cancer, you don't have a lot of time to sequence.
Well, in some ways, yes. I mean, if you look at the second line studies report survival and progression-free survival as good as your first line studies because you have a select group of patients. Once you are eligible for second line, you already have good biology. So in some ways, sequencing makes a lot of sense because you're going to select those patients who are more likely, or your approach is actually rational as well. Because if you start with FOLFOX in a patient who's borderline performer status and the patient does well and is able to tolerate FOLFOX, that means likely that the biology is better, then adding irinotecan in that patient would make sense. So that's an approach that actually rational. Sequencing may make sense. So FOLFOXIRI versus FOLFOX followed by FOLFIRI or irinotecan, or you know, adding irinotecan eventually would make a lot of sense.
Rich, you had a comment?
So one of the general comments I would make is that we are seeing almost no new development in cytotoxics by pharmaceutical companies. And yet, most of what we're talking about is our framework for treatment is cytotoxics in GI cancer. You know, the only real things we're seeing are nanopackaging paclitaxel or, you know, delivering the cytotoxics we already have a different way. And so I would make a plea that we not forget that cytotoxics are the framework of our treatment. You know, the other thing I would say is that I do have a tendency to use FOLFOX in second line in pancreas cancer based, again, on relatively small European studies, but studies that do show some benefit. You know, a lot of patients don't really come to second line therapy. In the first line, a lot of the patients that I'm dealing with are older, they're in their 70s, and I'll give them a choice between FOLFIRINOX and gemcitabine. And some of them will choose gemcitabine. They'll say, you know, I want to try and do something, but I don't want to submit myself to the potential side effects of the more intensive regimen.
And the other thing that I think has affected this whole field is the proclivity for companies and researchers to add to gemcitabine plus. And of course, that's been the standard, and that's not inappropriate, but there have been dozens of studies, and with the exception of GemCis and biliary tract cancers and gemerlotinib, there's really no individual study that's actually held together, although there's some trends. There's some interesting new molecules that are also being developed with gem, and you wonder if they're going to have the same fate. Threshold has a drug which looks semi-interesting in a randomized phase 2, and I worry that some of these strategies might work with other combinations, and that gemcitabine doesn't play so well with other drugs, and that may be part of the problem.
So this is a field of engagement that's littered with bodies, not just that of the people afflicted with the disease, but the drugs that we've
Absolutely.
Tried to
mm-hmm.
use.
I'm curious from my colleagues, who's using nab-paclitaxel for pancreas cancer and sort of when and with what, if anything?
Axel, what about nab-paclitaxel and pancreatic?
You know, I personally have used it in one or two patients. I know that Steve Alberts in our group is using it much more frequently. And I mean, we know that a phase 3 trial is ongoing. They keep upping up the sample size, apparently, of this phase 3 trial as they go. I know whether that's based on interim analysis and they haven't reached the p-value yet or whether it's some other reason. I hope it's an active drug. I would love to see more treatment options. I would love to see something that added to gemcitabine actually works. But it would be interesting to see whether it would be our current standard for clinical trial eligible patient, which is FOLFIRINOX.
Getting back before Charlie comments, just in terms of the biology of pancreatic cancer, I guess when Dan Van Hoff again had presented the initial data on NAB, you brought up this issue of SPARC. Is that for real or is there any biology?
I think this, again, something where I'd like to see the data from phase 3. And
there's
I hope there's no SPARC.
I mean, the disappointment to me is with that hint that there's no stratification for SPARC.
It's not stratified, but they're collecting tissue, I hope.
Correct. And the other real disappointment, for example, is the model of pancreas cancer that looks like the hedgehog pathway may be useful, and yet you have, frankly, negative studies just with hedgehog inhibitors. So really, we are not making progress.
Charlie?
Yeah, I was just relating to Axel's point about how the nab-paclitaxel trial has gotten larger and larger. So now we have to presume that with 850 patients, this study is now powered to find a very small benefit. And this is a point that Lee Ellis will frequently make at meetings, namely, why are we designing studies to find an improvement of a few weeks? So that if that study achieves what it's designed to do with 850 people, what have we really accomplished?
So let me play the devil's advocate on this one. So I agree in principle that small differences may not matter as much, but in pancreas cancer, I think it's something to continue building on. So we're talking about, you know, biologics, essentially killing so many biologics because we've actually used a weakling, gemcitabine, as the backbone. If it's true, although I still have my doubts that gem nab-paclitaxel is going to be significantly better than gemcitabine, but let's say, you know, the difference is reasonable, then it could serve as a reasonable platform for considering biologics adding to it.
But that would be only true if you really thought there was a biologic that needed nab-paclitaxel for it to be an active drug, because otherwise all you're doing, I mean, we're all speculating, and maybe it'll be wildly positive. But if it's another erlotinib, then what do you, I don't know that
that's I understand. I do think that taxanes are probably more reason. So across different malignancies, gemcitabine does not seem to play well with biologics. Taxanes seem to do a little bit better, so perhaps.
But coming back to Charlie's point, I mean, if our current FDA regulatory environment allows you to just shoot for a positive p-value to get a drug approved, I mean, then we'll continue to see these trials that don't add value. And I would actually propose a very easy metric. I mean, let's say hazard ratio base, if something's below 0.8 and overall survival, below 0.7 PFS, that is of interest. And everything else should not, you should not even power studies that way.
But unless hazard ratio of 0.8 for a pancreas study, that was erlotinib. It was 0.8.
Yeah, but erlotinib was 0.83, 0.82. So that would have not cut the threshold. Yeah.
Well, I agree. These are the issues we have to grapple with. The other, what I foresee happening is the gem nab-paclitaxel versus gem alone will show a benefit, and the survival will be 7.1 months in the gem nab-paclitaxel. Here you've got FOLFIRINOX data with an 11 or 12 month survival, and they're both going to be standards. And this is really a problem for the field. Now, we did a study with gem nab-paclitaxel plus, I think, capecitabine. Mm-hmm. And we were just totally underwhelmed. Now, that was just our series. We saw no evidence of really much more activity than we might have expected from GEM alone.
Now, Alan, when you hypothesize 7.1 months, you're not talking about difference. You're talking
I'm talking about total overall.
Yes.
I'm just throwing that out there. I'm saying 7.1. You can write it down.
7.
The control arm will be
six
or 6.2.
Not that it was 7 months better.
No. I'm saying 7.1 versus 6.2 is
That with or without SPARC?
No, but... and the point is, if they show that the SPARC subset does better, then I'm going to go back and say, if they really believe that, why didn't they stratify for that in the first place? That's what I find hard to believe about the whole story is it doesn't resonate with me. If they really had the courage of their conviction, they would have acted on that information.
Yeah, you know, this is really bothersome. You know, when you talk about studies where there's, you know, less than 1 month difference in, you know, progression-free or overall survival. And I just wonder when, you know, we're participating, you all put patients on this study, we could just refuse to do that. But, you know, is the problem that we have studies, these huge studies like that, or is maybe a correlated problem that we don't insist upon having biologic translational studies as part of it? You know, we had this huge CALGB breast cancer study presented at ASCO, you know, NAB versus paclitaxel versus Ix. And, you know, from the beginning, you could say, well, gee, that doesn't look that exciting. But I was like, well, let's see what the biology shows. But they didn't have any of that yet.
But you know, this study actually was interesting because it reaffirms paclitaxel standard of care. It actually has exactly the opposite effect. I mean, it's confirmed a very cheap, very old standard of care. So I actually think this study was useful. Now, coming back to the correct study, for instance, regorafenib, where we didn't select for biomarkers, a patient population unmet need, it was 760 patients, large study. Now, the benefit of having a large study is now we can really tease out biomarkers retrospectively and say, you know, if we didn't have the large study, we could not do that with annotated biospecimen. And the similar is, I think, is true for when the KRAS study, I mean, when the EGF receptor antibodies were tested in colon cancer, last line, if they didn't have biospecimen in the panitumumab trial, they would have never come to the finding, which was one of the greatest findings in colon cancer in recent years, that KRAS mutant tumors don't benefit. So I think there is a struggle, and we recently had a meeting, a clinical trials planning meeting, in terms of how to move trials forward in colorectal cancer. And there were the lumpers and the splitters. Should you now dissect patient populations into small biomarker-driven subsets, or should you run large trials, annotate biospecimen, and then try to find correlation between a certain marker and outcome on a certain therapy? And I think this is something which we have been struggling with and will continue to struggle for a long time.
And Neil, of course, the dilemma for those of us around this table, our view is not matched by the industry that is looking to develop drugs and has a metric that can get them a drug developed and marketed that may not meet what would be our ideal. And again, that gets a little bit back to what I've said. I've been at the podium for two of the last three ASCOs discussing ex-US studies, which is how much of the research is being done elsewhere. Largely, not only, but largely with a great deal of driving from the pharmaceutical industry. And on the other hand, we all participate in studies that look for small differences. Now, if you're aggressive in getting tissue, then again, it may be worth doing. But so this is a conflict that I think we all face.
And you know, when you're just talking about your study, 8405, we all agree that it will not meet its primary endpoint.
Right.
Which, I mean, there's not going to be a difference in overall survival. Still, it's a very important study because you have with all the biospecimen biomarker studies and the question of patient selection for first-line anti-VEGF or anti-EGF receptor therapy. I mean, even if we know there will not be the study can only be negative for its primary endpoint, but it's still a very important study.
Right, but that's again with tissue acquisition.
Absolutely.
I think the pox on the studies that are being done in this era that don't have tissue biorepositories, that just shouldn't be acceptable, I don't think.
Okay, let's go on and talk a little bit about gastric, esophageal, and anal cancers. And I want to begin talking about one part of gastric cancer. Again, Charlie, we get a lot of questions about, which is HER2-positive disease. We just did an hour-long program just on HER2-positive breast cancer. So much going on there. Here's a clinical situation, Charlie, that was submitted to us. A 59-year-old patient with a gastric adenocarcinoma, biopsy-proven liver mets, has a partial response after five cycles of trastuzumab, capecitabine, and cisplatinum, but then progressed after 8 months while receiving maintenance trastuzumab. What second-line therapy would you think about? What about other anti-HER therapies, lapatinib? And now we're hearing about pertuzumab in breast cancer.
Yeah, well, as often is the case, we in GI are a decade behind those in breast cancer. And the trastuzumab data are exciting, and it's certainly standard of care for HER2-positive gastric cancer. Following progression of frontline chemo and trastuzumab, I personally would not recommend continuing trastuzumab because we don't have any data to support that. The role of the other molecules currently proven in breast cancer, like lapatinib or pertuzumab, is an area of interest in research in gastric cancer, and maybe, in fact, it will work. Biologically, you would imagine it would work similarly in gastric cancer, but we don't know. So those molecules I wouldn't personally use. There are two studies of lapatinib, both in first line and in second line, in HER2-positive gastric cancer, and there will be pertuzumab studies as well.
So, Tony, we were talking earlier on about continuation of bevacizumab in colon cancer on progression. As Charlie said, in breast cancer, this is now sort of standard of care to continue some kind of anti-HER therapy. Are there any situations right now in gastric HER2-positive adenocarcinoma where you would continue anti-HER therapy on progression?
I must say that the data is lacking, and so it would be very difficult to justify that. Unfortunately, again, gastric cancer is not breast cancer in many ways in terms of its biology. Second-line therapy ends up being very limited in those patients. In fact, you lose about 50% of your patients before they are eligible for second-line. And those that are eligible for second-line across multiple studies have a very short progression-free survival and overall survival. So even inferring from anecdotal data would be very difficult, and I think it's very difficult to justify maintaining HER2 therapy in the absence of actual randomized study data.
So, Axel, we were looking to see if there's anything new in HER2-positive gastric cancers. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot since the original TOGA study. There were a couple papers at the GI symposium looking at HER2-positive gastric cancer. Any comments on those or anything else you've seen?
I mean, it's interesting in the sense of what's the biology of HER2-positive G-junction gastric cancers compared to breast cancer. We know in breast cancer, HER2-positive breast cancers have very poor prognosis. So targeting HER2 is actually reversing the poor prognosis into some better prognosis. And now the interesting thing, and there are two studies at ASCO GI, and there's actually a published paper from the Mayo Clinic group in clinical cancer research this year, looked at the actual prognostic implication for HER2 overexpression in G junction and gastric cancer. In contrast to breast cancer, HER2 overexpression is not associated with poor prognosis. Actually, even in the TOGA study, when you look at the control arm and you looked at consecutively higher protein expression levels, there seems to be actually an improved outcome in the patients who had higher HER2 expression levels compared to lower expression levels, even the absence of trastuzumab. Now, when you adjust for, let's say, other confounding factors like the fact that HER2 overexpression is more likely in intestinal cancers compared to diffuse cancers, more in G-junction than gastric cancer, etc. If you take all this into equation, HER2 has no prognostic implication for a G-junction gastric cancer, which I think is the bottom line of all these population studies in the end. And we do know, though, as Charlie said, that for HER2 overexpressors, mainly the immunohistochemistry 3+, IHC2+, and FISH-positive tumors, if you lump these two groups together, high protein expression, high amplification, that those patients benefit from trastuzumab in frontline therapy, which should be considered standard of care because, you know, you really shift overall survival by about 5 months for these patients.
So a related question we got, Axel, about this. Anything new in terms of standardizing HER2 testing in gastric cancer? When this first came out, there was a lot of debate about that.
Yeah, so when we talk about immunohistochemistry and talk about FISH testing, so the FISH cutoff of amplification is very similar to the breast cancer cutoff, you know, which is twofold amplification. Although if you really talk to our genomics guys, a real amplified tumor is way beyond this 2x threshold. Immunohistochemistry, I think the caveat is that we cannot really transfer the breast cancer standard, you know, 1+, 2+, 3+ staining scores to gastric cancer because of subtle differences. So we really have to have educated pathologists on the staining and grading of gastric cancers and G-junction cancers, which is different than breast cancer. So when you talk about FDA approval of trastuzumab, they say, you know, trastuzumab is approved for the use in patients with HER2 overexpressed gastric and G-junction cancer according to standard tests, whatever that means. It leaves it wide open.
So let's talk a little bit about the rest of gastric cancer. And Rich, we got a lot of questions concerning sort of clinical management. How do you approach the choice of chemotherapy in first and second line HER2-negative metastatic gastric cancer? Which platinum agent, infusional 5-FU versus capecitabine, doublet versus triplet, epirubicin versus non-epirubicin, which taxane?
So the good news in gastric cancer is lots of different drugs have activity. The bad news is that the activity is pretty short-lived, and the patients often are pretty short-lived as well. So the general principles that I would use for managing advanced gastric cancer is to use multiple agents, probably doublets most of the time. You know, we've got fluoropyrimidines that are active, taxanes, platinums, irinotecan, you know, really very many agents from which to choose. And I think a lot of times it's the toxicity and the preference of the physician that's managing the patient that should determine what your first line therapy is. I'm not a huge fan of capecitabine in patients who've had upper GI pathology, in part because it's an oral pill. I think they have a lot of oral symptoms, and I'm never sure that the drug that I want in their system is getting into their system. I find that if I'm going to use 5-FU, the 48-hour infusion is actually easier, the main toxicity being having to carry a pump around for 48 hours. So I'm not a big fan of CAPE in this regard. My common regimen is either a taxane plus platinum or irinotecan plus platinum. I actually like oxaliplatinum rather than CIS if I'm going to combine it with 5-FU. But I don't think you can be dogmatic about recommending a standard first-line therapy in gastric cancer. I think it's dealer's choice.
Charlie?
You know, I agree. We don't really know what the optimum first-line therapy is. But one study I think is informative was a randomized phase two done by CLGB, which, albeit all three arms had cetuximab in it, the chemotherapy was ECF versus irinotecan, cisplatin versus FOLFOX. And if you really look across efficacy and tolerability, FOLFOX was the winner within a randomized phase two, namely irinotecan, cisplatin had the worst efficacy. ECF and FOLFOX were comparable in efficacy, but FOLFOX was better tolerated. So that if you try to infer from that study, it would suggest that FOLFOX is a reasonable first-line therapy.
Okay, Bert, a case from an oncologist, 66-year-old man who developed peritoneal metastatic disease 2 years after the diagnosis of stage 2 gastric adenocarcinoma with no adjuvant therapy, no hepatic metastases. How would you approach a patient like this, and would you consider intraperitoneal chemo?
Not for this disease. We've referred people for peritoneal stripping and intraperitoneal chemotherapy with more indolent diseases. I think with a disease like gastric cancer, which tends to be aggressive, the patient's going to be better off with systemic chemotherapy, in which case all the discussion we've just had really applies. You know, is this an ECF? Is this a FOLFOX? Is this an EOX? But for this particular entity, I can't recall ever referring someone for intraperitoneal treatment.
Tony, you were bringing up the issue of neoadjuvant therapy before. What about neoadjuvant therapy of gastric cancer and also neoadjuvant therapy of HER2-positive gastric cancer?
So that's an interesting question. So neoadjuvant therapy for gastric cancer, there's enough data on the potential benefit of chemotherapy prior. And we're talking about pure gastric, excluding GE tumors. GE tumors really fall in between esophagus and gastric, and the data is less clear about the value of radiation. So prior neoadjuvant, or the more correct term is perioperative chemotherapy, meaning giving chemotherapy before and after surgery, has a well-established role from the MAGIC trial prior to resection of gastric cancer. For GE tumors, you could potentially consider that approach versus a pure esophagus approach, which means adding radiation to chemotherapy prior to resection. In terms of HER2-positive gastric cancer, perioperatively, whether there is value to adding trastuzumab or not is actually something under investigation. I, on a personal note, although this is outside the label, for at least younger patients where I want to be aggressive, I do tend to actually add trastuzumab to a taxane-based regimen in HER2-positive gastric cancer.
That's interesting. Alan, would you use trastuzumab as neoadjuvant therapy of gastric cancer?
Great question. Don't know the answer. I think that's better done on a study than ad hoc, and I probably wouldn't use it outside of a study, but I think neoadjuvant therapy is, of course, for most of us, the standard, but I would probably not use trastuzumab in that setting.
Axel?
As I said, a great question. Have I done it? Yes. Would I consider the standard of care? No. I mean, adding trastuzumab. I do use neoadjuvant perioperative chemotherapy according to MAGIC. We should point out for GE junction cancer, there's an intergroup trial up and running, an RTOG trial, looking at radiochemotherapy with trastuzumab for HER2-positive cancers in a perioperative fashion, actually. So it shows it's an area of investigation. Would I consider this, again, as something intriguing with a larger, bulky tumor that hasn't metastasized using trastuzumab? Yes.
Charlie, have you or would you use trastuzumab as neoadjuvant therapy in gastric cancer?
I have not used it. We have a study open, but I haven't had a chance to enroll anybody on it.
So you would give the patient, for example, chemotherapy without trastuzumab?
Correct. In the absence of data, I would not give trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting.
Well, let me throw that scenario. What if you have an actual patient, a younger patient with a symptomatic tumor where a response rate is needed that's HER2 positive? I would argue that for that particular patient, you are relatively justified to use trastuzumab in addition to chemotherapy because you improve your response rate and you know the symptoms are related to the bulk of the tumor.
Yeah. Neoadjuvant, preoperatively. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Not adjuvant.
With somebody with an existing tumor, certainly if they were borderline resectable and I thought I was treating locally advanced disease, I'd consider it.
Matt, what's your take on this? I mean, we're not going to add much toxicity. I don't know if you can get trastuzumab paid for, but shouldn't be adding much toxicity. Have you done it? Would you do it?
I haven't. I mean, I would certainly, though, consider it in the situation that we were just talking about where you need to get a response. Thinking about it more broadly, does it help in the adjuvant setting? There, I would really want to see more data.
Rich?
Ditto. I think I would consider it in somebody with locally advanced disease that's symptomatic and where a response is really important.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about esophageal cancer. Here's a question in terms of a case we got, Alan. A 61-year-old fit patient with adenocarcinoma of the esophagus and one liver lesion. Would you resect both the cancer in the esophagus and the liver or give neoadjuvant therapy?
So as we talked about, it's the exceptions that make the rule. And I would not upfront do something to a liver lesion. I would treat the patient for local management, which might still be chemo-rads, and then follow the disease. We have on occasion gone after isolated liver lesions if they truly are isolated a year or two down the road. In fact, I just had a young woman I did this in who had a year disease-free interval after we did that. So I never say never, but in general, I wouldn't do anything about the liver up front unless when I was doing surgery, it was right there in front of the surgeon. But in my view, you have to be really aggressive about the local disease because these patients, if you can't command local control, then the patients have just a miserable existence.
So Matt, we asked if you would comment on the New England Journal paper that came out this year looking at pre-op chemo radiation for esophageal cancer.
Sure. So the question of neoadjuvant chemoradiation esophageal cancer has been one that has probably been going on for decades. And just by way of example, our own experience, you could go to one big medical center in the city and get surgery up front previously, and you could then drive 20 minutes and you would get chemoradiation.
20 minutes. Let's see.
20 minutes.
Is there a bridge?
So that was the situation. This study, I think, answers a question. It was 368 patients with esophageal cancer randomized to receive either preoperative treatment with carboplatin, paclitaxel, and radiation followed by surgery or surgery alone. The side effects for the preoperative treatment were as anticipated. The results were remarkable. So complete resection was achieved in 92% of those patients who received preoperative chemoradiation, as compared to only 69% of the patients who received surgery alone. Moreover, of those patients who received chemoradiation and were resected, 29% of those had pathologic CRs. So clearly something was happening with the preoperative chemoradiation. I think the real meat of the study, of course, is in the ultimate outcomes. And for the resected patients, looking first at disease-free survival with chemoradiation was actually not reached. Disease-free survival in those who had surgery alone was 24 months, so difference in disease-free survival. And finally, for overall survival, 49 months in those patients who received preoperative chemoradiation followed by surgery, and only 24 months in patients who received surgery alone. So a big study that I think pretty much answers the question. I guess the one thing I would perhaps even throw out to the group, if you look at some of the subsets, we have always tended to lump esophageal cancer with squamous cell and with the adenos. And the benefit really seemed to be much greater in the squamous cell than in the adeno. So you sort of wonder, if this had been a pure adenocarcinoma study, would the effect size have been as large?
What about that question, Charlie?
It's a great point, and it was an issue when they presented it at ASCO. It obviously is a post hoc analysis at this point, but there has been studies to suggest that squamous cell do have a better response to neoadjuvant therapy as opposed to adenocarcinoma. Nonetheless, there are adenocarcinoma trials showing a benefit of neoadjuvant chemoradiation that were exclusively adenocarcinoma. So in face value, I think that the bottom line about this is that for a patient with adenocarcinoma, because we don't see many squamous cell at our center, for those patients with adeno, I would recommend carbotax radiation preoperatively.
Axel?
So, Charlie, what about the radiation dose? Because, I mean, one of the intriguing issues here was they got away with a radiation dose of 41 gray. And in our center, we had discussions about whether this was actually the reason why adenocarcinomas didn't do as well, because we might need higher radiation dose. We actually, and it depends on the radiation oncologist who sees a patient, they might actually up the dose to 50.4 gray in adenocarcinomas and stay with 41 gray for the squamous cell cancers. I mean, we don't have any data right now from this study, but I mean, just throwing it out there, there's a difference in radiation dose compared to what we've done so far.
Well, the squamous cell, because, you know, the esophagus tend to be much more sensitive to radiation and chemotherapy.
That's why, you know, the adenocarcinomas might be under-treated with the radiation
dose. I fully agree with you. The point is that I fully agree with you that it could be the dose of the radiation, because you have a much more sensitive group with the squamous, and the adenos may not have been optimally treated. Yet you do see those, even with a less than optimal radiation dose, you still do see those responses.
I mean, it's actually a study that has influenced our standard of care.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, we, for squamous, definitely, there's no question about this, because especially also these side effects are much more tolerable than what we've seen with 5-FU cisplatin therapy. And for adenocarcinomas, I think the question is still out there whether we can optimize the regimen, including higher dose of radiation therapy.
Any other issues, Rich, that come up in terms of esophageal cancer? Any questions that you get about it? Any myths or misperceptions?
Well, one of the questions has to do with people with proximal third of the esophagus tumors. And a lot of those are squamous cell carcinomas, and many of them are managed just with chemoradiation without resection because of the potential need for laryngectomy and other troubling effects of the necessary surgery. So, you know, I think that again points out the fact that you get a higher CR rate for these squamous cells and that that is a consideration in their management.
Tony?
So one point to emphasize, and that's the basis of the 80302 and the 80803 CLGB studies, is that in many of these, as in perhaps with the carboplatin radiation, the issue is less present, but with the prior use of cisplatin 5-FU radiation, there was a significant risk of mucositis, and 25%+ of the patients end up with a G-tube. In these instances, and the basis of the studies in CLGB, starting with chemotherapy prior to chemotherapy and radiation seems to drop the need for a feeding tube to less than 5%, which is what we've seen on those studies and in actual practice. So that's one thing, gave a message, you know, to the community practitioner about the importance of considering chemotherapy prior to chemotherapy and radiation. Now, again, it may become less relevant with the carboplatin radiation because you do end up with much lesser risk of mucositis and neutropenia.
So let's finish out just commenting briefly about anal cancer. And Bert, we asked you to respond to a clinical situation that was submitted to us. 39-year-old man, confirmed HIV infection, presents with a 4-centimeter anal mass that proves to be squamous cell cancer, no metastasis. What therapy would you recommend, and would you be comfortable using capecitabine instead of 5-FU?
The short answer about the capecitabine is no. You know, at this point, I think sort of like testicular cancer, this is a disease where you don't mess with the regimen because it's been very successful. And so it's really continuous infusion 5-FU, and mitomycin is a clearly important component. The HIV issue is important here because, you know, in the past we were worried about the myelosuppression of mitomycin in patients with HIV, but, you know, assuming the patient is well managed from the standpoint of antiretroviral therapy, that really doesn't seem to be a problem. In other words, we don't see
more complications or infectious complications in our HIV population any more than our non-HIV population. So mitomycin 5-FU with radiation would be my recommendation for a patient like this.
Axel?
I agree.
Anything new, Alan, in anal cancer?
Well, the disappointment that what we thought would be advances aren't, so the use of platinum. I do think there's a possibility that EGFR antibodies may make an impact, although so far, no. I think the problem, as Bert alluded to, when you hit a home run in your first at bat in the major leagues, it's tough to have an encore. And now, it is clear, though, that not all these patients are created equal. So the size of the mass, we don't cure a subset of patients, and those are the patients we need to focus on. But the patients with garden variety anal cancer, I think it's hard to advance beyond where we are now.
This concludes our special Web Extra audio segment. Special thanks to the faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special Clinical Investigator Think Tank on GI cancers.